This is a YUN interview with Professor David Apter at Yale University on February the 27th, 1991. The interviewer is Sutherland. I'm now testing the mics to see if the mics both work. This is the first mic. And this is the second mic to see if it works too. So, Professor Apter, I want first to express appreciation for your willingness to participate in this Yale Oral History Project on the United Nations. And if I might, I'd like first to ask you to indicate your connection with the Congo. What were you doing in the Congo during the period of the crisis there in the 60s?
Well, I had made several trips to the Congo under various auspices, mainly to interview people. And my first interest was to contrast the slow pace of evolution towards political autonomy in the Congo as compared with countries I had been working with and which I was interested, like Ghana, Nigeria, Uganda, Senegal, Cote d'Ivoire, mainly. I had also spent some time in Kenya and, of course, Tanzania. My main field work had been in Ghana, or what was originally Gold Coast, on the problem of the transition from dependence to independence via mass nationalist movements, in which the procedure, in effect, was the mobilization of support, the enlargement of voting and electoral methods, the expansion of the franchise, and the transformation of legislative bodies from non-representative to increasingly representative, and then essentially parliamentary bodies in which cabinet responsibility, parliamentary accountability, and effective internal self-government would be the last step before which power would be transferred. And that was, one way or another, the procedure in virtually all British African countries within the Commonwealth framework. And something very different, but in effect, in the end, similar, was followed in French Africa. This also, in both cases, was accompanied by the clear recognition that part of the process was based on education, and especially the expansion of higher education. And so one of the things that struck me in the Congo was, by holding back on any kind of higher education, and indeed minimizing education, although they did vary the extent of educational reform according to province, on the theory in the Congo that you raised up the level of a whole group of people within a province or ethnic group and not piecemeal. But there was very little progress, and there were hardly any skilled people, any trained people, any doctors, and so on. So that was one of the more particular interests I had, was to see who were the nationalist leaders who I could interview and meet before independence. How could I compare them with their counterparts in French-speaking and English-speaking Africa? And given this educational lack, or the fundamental unavailability of Africans skilled enough to participate in effective political and administrative life, what was likely to happen. So I was there for several weeks. The last visit was several weeks up until the Day of Independence, when I slipped over the border from the Katanga to Uganda, because I expected pretty much of a bloodbath.
So in this period then, you were there before independence, were you able to meet a number of the nationalist leaders?
Yes, I met, I'm a little hazy about names at this point, I met Lumumba several times and interviewed him. I met Chombe, I met Kasavubu, I met several others from the central area. I never met Gazinga, whom I wanted very much to meet, but who had been more or less sealed off in eastern Congo.
In Stanley.
Yes.
Could you give me your impressions, to begin with Mr. Lumumba at that period before he became Prime Minister?
Yes, I was surprised by him. I knew something about his background, of course, and he'd been a postal clerk and so on. But I expected somehow a more accomplished personality. If he was a diamond, he was certainly in the rough. And I wasn't really prepared also for the extent to which he was an explosive. Even his language came out in short, explosive bursts, almost like slogans. And he would be more or less uncomprehending of the questions you asked, or at least paid no attention to them, until some word triggered a response that he wanted to make. So it was impossible, I found, to have the kind of normal conversation you would have when you interview political leaders. It was as if there was something mechanical about him as a personality. And physically, too, he sort of twitched, and there was an intensity and a nervousness and an almost explosive quality that an inability to sit still, which I just found surprising. I had never experienced that in dealing with another political figure. He also seemed to be ill at ease where he wasn't totally familiar with the surroundings. So I would say he was a person with lacking in what might be called the social skills of politics, but who had a certain ferocity in the way he spoke, and a determination. And what came out were slogans, and the slogans themselves were perfectly comprehensible. And one had the feeling that this was an ideologue who had no particular ideology, but pieces of an ideology had been programmed into him, and he thought in those terms when he was, at least when he was dealing in French with another, with somebody from outside his own general environment. So I was more amazed. I wouldn't call it a real interview. I was just quite fascinated by him as a personality, and wondered what he would be like when he had to actually deal with concrete problems. I couldn't imagine him actually sitting down and having the patience to think through something, as distinct from being a kind of immediately reactive political leader.
Well, that was exactly my next question. In talking to him, did you get any sense that he had any understanding of the role that lay ahead for him as in this new country?
It's hard to say. As I say, it wasn't a real interview because it went on for some time. I guess my recollection is that it brings up a statement people used to make in Uganda when I would ask politicians the same sort of question. They would say to me, "You don't cut up a cow until you kill it." I had the feeling that he wasn't thinking very far ahead. His immediate universe were the consisted of the Belgians, his enemies, the fact that he had enemies everywhere in the Congo, that his essential ability was both to attract people as a kind of very dynamic, nervous, tense personality, thin, angular, quick, angry, bristly, but also precisely because of this, he kept everybody off guard. I mean, he'd catch them out. They wouldn't. He had a high degree of unpredictability. So I would say that his preoccupation wasn't really what would happen afterwards, except in some very general, not terribly comprehending way. I don't even suppose he had a good conception of what the whole country was like.
And going on from the future prime minister to the future president, Mr. Kasavubu, what was your impression of him, and how did they compare?
Totally different personality. Where physically they were entirely different. Where Lumumba was tense, nervous. As I recall, he was quite tall, very thin, angular face. Kasavubu was short, heavy, placid. One had the sense he very wise, very patient, somebody who'd come up from the inside of African politics, with a very sure sense of what the pieces were, at least in terms of the. Of the Congolese, I've forgotten which ethnic group he comes from at the moment, it'll come back to me. But of course, this is another thing. The ethnic divisions were not only very, very strong and regionally differentiated for administrative purposes, but also under the Belgians, some ethnic groups had been pushed ahead much faster than others. So you had a larger component of, say, educated people amongst one group than you would with another. And this introduced into an already generally inward-looking set of communities resistance and hostility between ethnic groups, which as I say, had been originally part of a design to keep a kind of balance within on the part of the Belgian government, rather than simply divide people. I mean, it's too easy to say that it was just a divide and conquer kind of tactic. I think there was a strategy of preventing unrest and kind of multiple programs in medical facilities, educational facilities, housing, road infrastructure, which would favor one province and one ethnic group as over against another. So Kasavubu, one had the sense within his own ethnic group, which included, of course, what was then Leopoldville, was totally in command of the situation and was a chief.
Oh. And the sense of hostility toward the Belgians or other foreigners did not come through in the case of Kasavubu the way it did in Chombe.
Lumumba. No, not at all. My feeling was that he knew how to work with them. He could take them or leave them. He wasn't intimidated by them. He was his own person.
Now, did you have an opportunity to meet Mobutu at that point?
No.
No.
I never met Mobutu.
Because he was more or less in the background still.
Yes.
Then.
Yes.
In the army. Going on then to Chombe, a remarkable figure, I think. How would you characterize
him?
Well,
Chombe also was, I didn't have a much chance to talk to him. I heard him give a speech and I was introduced to him afterwards and had a bit of a chat with him. Chombe was the best politician. One had the sense that he was although his own group was just as local as any of the others, and I've forgotten the names of the ethnic groups, I could easily find out for you. He was very polished as a speaker. He was it's quite charming, fun, easy to talk to. He was probably the most Europeanized and knew how to deal with the Union Minière, and he knew how to deal with and liked Europeans, and got on well with the Katangi's administration. One had the sense he was the most familiar in terms of social and political accomplishment, although he had already, by the time I met him, he was already regarded as a reactionary by virtually all the other political leaders. So he was, in a certain sense, again, self-assured, but more of a cosmopolitan, more of a man of the world, even though that world, in fact, was rooted in the Katanga, which is where I met him. But the Katanga itself was full of Europeans, and was, in that sense, very Europeanized, with some of the best research facilities in the country in terms of, in academic terms in Katanga, and so there was a sense in which, while it was far away from the center, it was a center of its own.
Now, going in at this point and talking to a good many of the people in Katanga and the rest of the Congo, you were approaching it in an analytical perspective, so to speak, as to its the administrative capacity, the administrative procedures. Would you have assessed the country as ready for transition to independence at that point, or did you find it totally unprepared?
Well, I expected it to be a shambles. That's why I left. I expected it to explode. There are tensions, and there are many other political leaders whom I interviewed, and as I say, whose names I have forgotten. It wouldn't take me long to go back over my notes, but some went to England, and I got to know some of them. One very bright young political leader went to St. Anthony's College at Oxford. Thomas Kanza.
Thomas Kanza,
yeah,
yes.
But there were many others, and yes, I thought the country was in no way ready for independence. I thought the Belgians had not pulled a De Gaulle in Guinea kind of thing, where he just simply, in a fit of ill-temper, pulled out everything, all the equipment. Not like that. I think the Belgians thought that by speeding up the transition very fast, they would in effect inherit the pieces. And in to a large extent, that's exactly what happened. But they made no real effort. I think everybody threw up their hands at once the pace was established. And the Belgians were really very anxious, because I think they thought it would be a disaster, to avoid responsibility for it by in any way impeding the transition, but letting the chips fall where they may. That was my impression, anyway. Now, I did talk to some senior government officials, again, whose names I've forgotten, and also the Governor General of Rwanda, and they all, almost to a man, deplored Brussels' policy. They found it extremely irresponsible, and they all expected a bloodbath.
So that going into it, as the United Nations did, it could have been anticipated that there were going to be grave difficulties.
Yes. I think I wrote for Africa Report or something like that while I was still there, in anticipation of precisely what happened.
And the level of education was deplorable, as I understand it. Did you find that to be true throughout your contacts in.
Yes. One did find, of course, all medical technicians, school teachers, all of whom, because it was the Belgians were still there, had to do their jobs. I mean, there was a certain level of competence within. What I didn't find was general incompetence. I found just low Africanization of positions where competence was required. But where Africans were in place, they seemed to be reasonably proficient, sometimes better, more proficient than their English-speaking or French-speaking counterparts. So I think where primary education was done, it was done reasonably well.
Now, did you meet the man who became the interior minister of Katanga, Mr. Manungo?
Yes. I had dinner, I believe it was dinner, drinks first on the veranda of his very nice house, and then dinner. I was in the company of an anthropologist who had written a book called The Premise of Inequality in Rwanda, Jacques Maquet. And it was through Jacques Maquet that I was taken on this trip to interview people. I'm not sure I interviewed Tshombe on that same that day or in a few days on that particular, even in that particular visit, because I made several visits and I don't remember. But the way I met Godfrey Manungo was rather amusing. We were driving in a big American car, and we entered his territory, and the car got absolutely mired in the mud. And we were actually on our way to see him.
Let me just interrupt. Was this before or after independence?
This is before.
Mm-hmm.
And Chief Manungo simply ordered a fairly large group of men to come, and they literally lifted the car out of the mud, and then we were invited in for a very gracious, and I would say a totally cynical conversation. And as I remember the conversation, I have this feeling that since I was fairly young, and Godfrey Manungo was just simply amused. But he had high regard for Jacques Maquet, and there were several other, I think, Belgian administrators around. But Manungo was very much at the center of things. I mean, the administrators, he and the administrators had a kind of joking relationship that was very relaxed. There was no question of what they call today otherness. They were all part of the same organization, you might say, and each had his part to play.
He also, I believe, was a chief of a tribe.
Oh yes, and it was his followers who pulled us out of the mud.
Yeah. He has been portrayed in some of the writings on Katanga as a very cruel person, very cruel man, capable of all sorts of crimes. Did you get any inkling of that in your meeting with him?
Not really. I would have said that he had an enormous sense of power, and that he would do anything necessary, or anything within his power that he regarded to be necessary. But I've had this about other people as well. I did think he was exceptionally, how should I put it, autonomous as a personality. That he was on a very much the centerpiece. I wouldn't say that the administrators felt inferior to him, but I had the feeling that he could have treated them as if they were small boys if he'd chosen to do it. But he was quite affable and correct, and had a great sense of humor, and as I say, was a sardonic sense of humor. And one had the feeling he was accustomed to the exercise of power, but more than that, I really couldn't say.
And on the conservative side?
Oh, yes. I would say conservative in the real sense of the term. That is to say, he didn't think these politicians were worth a damn. He had absolute contempt for them, and he had respect for what he considered himself to be part of, the Belgian administration, and he really couldn't understand why the Belgians were paying any attention to these people who were nothing as far. And he used the term troublemakers, they're nothing but troublemakers.
Now, there have been suggestions later that he was directly involved in the final murder of Lumumba. In your connections, did you hear anything about that?
Yeah. I heard not very long after the murder of Lumumba from several people, and I'm not sure who they were now. One might have been Jacques Maquet himself. Another possibility is someone who's teaching at Boston University, who I think may have been with us on that occasion, Edouard Boustin. I think it was Boustin who told me that. And Boustin was making a study of the transition, so he was very likely to know that. He had very good sources of information, both on the Belgian side and on the African side.
And they indicated to their knowledge that Munungu was directly involved in Kasa.
Yes, and that, the information that I got, and I think also Connor Cruz O'Brien may have told me this, that Munungu's men working either with or under some kind of connection to both the Belgian police and the CIA, tipped off the Munungu that Lumumba was going to be in his area, and that probably the same men who pulled my car out of the mud went to work on him. I did hear one story that Munungu himself participated in the actual killing. Whether that's true or not, I have no idea. I wouldn't be surprised, let's put it this way.
He was probably capable of doing it. Were there other persons who made a particular impression on you in this period before the independence of?
There was a very interesting lawyer whose name was Rubens, who had decided that he was going to stay on, and who was highly respected in a circle of African nationalists who were themselves not very extreme. And Rubens, I had dinner with Rubens. Where did he live? I've forgotten. I wish I had a map of the Congo right in front of me. But he lived in another area, in an absolutely superb South African Dutch style Boer whitewashed house, very beautiful house, very large house. And he felt he could become a kind of senior politician, advisor, a man of goodwill, who could be at least more than an intermediary, but would accept the responsibilities of being a Zairean. And as I understand it, he didn't last very long. But he had a lot of wisdom. He had a lot of understanding about the different kinds of nationalism, which in the context of the time, people tended to put down as kind of simple-minded tribalism and not recognize that there was a great deal more to it than that. Sometimes a kind of class struggle between groups that had been held back and others that had been advanced. the big differences between those who have become much more industrialized, as in Katanga, with a large industrial labor force, and people's attitudes were much more complicated than it appeared. Everything ranging from groups of miners in the Katanga who were Flemish speaking, and whose reputation was to be the most violently anti-African, and yet because they were miners, had developed a kind of solidarity with African miners, which made them far more close and intimate with Africans at every level in terms of social life than you would have ever anticipated. And another thing that was startling, this goes from Leopoldville all the way down to what was then Elizabethville, the city, the Cité Africaine, was another world, was always another world. And Europeans they weren't unsafe in going in there, but they did not, in fact, penetrate that world in any way. And so the urban life was insulated, you might say, against Europeans.